time, friends are very helpful. But there are some times when they are not. There are some times that friends aren't helpful to us. When I was about 17 or 18, I had a choice to make about friendship. It was one of those moments in life when it sort of seared into your consciousness. So when I think of this time, I can see the place. I can see the clear skies, the green grass, the family house just a little bit over the way. This wasn't a huge thing, but it was quite important to me, and so it stuck with me. I had been friends with Stephen for about 5 years. We'd been through high school together. We'd been on the same soccer team. We'd spent a lot of time with one another. When early in my high school days, I found out he went to church, I went with him. It was a Presbyterian church. That is why I'm here with you today, because of Stephen's good influence in my life. We went to youth group, to the same Christian camps. But then as we began work, our paths began to separate. And the thing that was happening was just a simple thing, really. He was inviting me to join him with some of his new friends for a party. But it seemed to me at that moment that I had a choice to make, because if I continued with this friendship, it seemed to be leading me in a direction that I didn't necessarily want to go, because I wanted to spend those times with the youth group, with the leadership of the youth group and at church and helping. And so I just felt it was as if God, boom, struck me for a moment. It was as if I had this choice to make, not because what was being offered by Stephen was anything bad, not at all, but it was just one of those turning points in life where you have to make a choice. And would I, in a sense, follow that friendship that would now lead me further from God, or would I make a choice to stay with God? Of course, you understand what decision I made. When we have in our lives the opportunity, I suppose, the privilege of being parents, we take an interest in the friends of our children. Aunts and uncles do this also. You know, you watch the little ones and you take an interest in who their friends are, because we as adults know their friends will influence them. And if they get into the wrong crowd with the wrong friends, then we know they'll go along a certain path. And parents, aunts and uncles, we aren't always able to influence them with regard to this, but it doesn't stop us from trying. Just to encourage the good friendships that we believe will help them to make good choices in life. And I wonder what your experience of friendship has been. Have you had good friends who have given you good advice and been a real encouragement to you? Have you been a good friend to others? Melanie and I live out near the airport, and so often we go down to the little shopping centre down that way and often drive past the main freight building. Those of you who have been out to the airport may have noticed they've got this big blue sign on their building, and they put these sort of pithy sayings. This week, as I was getting ready for this message, they had a message up that said, "A friend is a person who walks in when the rest of the world walks away." Oh, that's quite a good definition of friendship. Today we're thinking about Job's friends and how they walked in to his life at a difficult time in his life. Their time with Job was a bit of a mixed bag. Overall, not as helpful as it really should have been. These friends inspired the phrase in English, "Job's comforters," which we use to mean someone who comes under this idea of sympathizing, giving us comfort. But actually, what they bring hurts us rather than helps us. Christopher Ashe highlighted the opening of the Geneva Bible's introduction to Job. This was written back in 1560. I thought this was, just the way it was phrased, sounded really good. These friends came unto him under the pretense of consolation, and yet they tormented him more than did all his afflictions. Now, I'm not sure that that's totally accurate, because the afflictions that Job had were really very, very bad. But rather than easing those afflictions, Job's friends add to them. In a sense, what plagued Job was not so much the boils on his skin, but the stinging words of his friends. Now, as we look at this interaction between Job and his friends, we need to remember this is Hebrew poetry. Here we have poetic language, the grand expanse of colourful imagery and metaphor to try and express theological ideas. So we read of growling lions who break their teeth and are no longer able to eat, the swiftness of the weaver's shuttle, and the monsters of the deep. And we're given pictures of a spider's web, and of the stars of Orion, and of eagles swooping in to catch their prey. We recall that this is wisdom writing, trying to express eternal mysteries that are beyond human grasp by using poetry to inspire our thinking. Prose, the historical narrative, in a sense, keeps us grounded. Whereas poetry isn't so tethered, it allows these flights of fantasy. It wants to lift us up to new heights so we see things from a new perspective. But that is challenging because poetry by its very nature is more open to interpretation. I know that there have been times when I have read these passages in Job, the speeches of the friends, without thinking or realizing, this is poetry. And when you forget that it's poetry, you don't see it as it's meant to be seen. So Job's three friends come, and in a sense, they represent a gathering of the wise men from round the known world. Here we have three wise men. We've got that in the story somewhere else as well. Three wise men, they come with the wisdom of the ages and the accepted understanding of God and sin and punishment. Now, remember, these are not people of Israel. They do not have the heritage of Moses and the Torah to shape their thinking about God. They are not in that sort of stage or understanding of God's revelation. They begin well. They sit quietly with Job, and sometimes we do this with our friends. And you may well have been in that situation where all you do is go into a friend's home and give them a hug and sit there. Because we know words simply are not enough. And at times when we try the words, we just feel, I know I haven't been able to convey what it is I really feel or want to give to my friend at this moment, at this point. We know words aren't enough. Simply being present, we hope, will give them strength. And so they waited and they mourned with Job and they kept silent. If only they had kept silent. Charles Swindoll notes, it begins as a mild discussion. Then it turns into an intense debate. And finally, it ends as a heated dispute. When I was thinking about these three friends and Job, it put me in mind of the early 1980s. There was a television program some of you might have seen. It was called On the Mat, and it was a wrestling program. These pro wrestlers, big guys. And sometimes you would have, there were goodies and there were baddies. And sometimes the goodie would have the baddie on the mat and have him in a hold. And he would be about to submit when one of the sneaky baddies would come around and jump into the ring and pull him off. And it would be two against one. And it sort of struck me, this is a little bit like Job. He's the good guy, alone in his corner, suffering, as these three friends take turns wrestling him with words and concepts of suffering and evil, and their aim is to drive him to submission, where he will confess his sin and repent. Eliphaz begins gently, as if reluctant to speak. If someone ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? But then he seems to jump straight off into the deep end. And in the same breath, he said, but who can keep from speaking? From him we learn that Job instructed many people, strengthened the feeble, supported the faltering, and those who stumbled he helped. Job was a good man. This description fits well with the character of Job that we read about in the early chapters. When people turned to him for help, Job was there and willing to support them. But Eliphaz soon turns up the heat in what he's saying. He's basically saying, Job, you are quick to give advice, but can you take it? You are quick to speak, but will you listen to others? Now, in one sense, that's a fair enough question. In Proverbs, we read, listen to advice and accept discipline, and at the end, you will be counted among the wise. The book of Proverbs makes it very clear, wise people will listen and learn. The difficulty with Eliphaz is that he doesn't give good advice. Each of the friends tends to legalistically argue that Job's suffering is proof that he has sinned and is being punished by God. So Eliphaz confidently asserts, consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? Well, I think you and I could answer that, because we know that sometimes people who are innocent suffer and sometimes die for seemingly no reason. Consider now, says Eliphaz, who being innocent has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? This was sort of the accepted wisdom in a general sense. God doesn't make the innocent perish or destroy the upright. Therefore, Job, you cannot be innocent or upright because you are being destroyed by God in your body and the things that have happened to you. And the problem is that they're making an assumption here about Job, whereas at the beginning of the book, God clearly calls Job his servant. And God, in a sense, although he's going through suffering, is sticking with him. God says of him, there is no one on earth like Job. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And the friends are working from a mistaken idea, wrong conclusions. Bildad is even more blunt than Eliphaz. He jumps right in. He says, and this is to Job, how long will you say such things? Your words are blustering wind. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? When your children sinned against him, he gave them over to the penalty of their sin. So he's accusing Job of being a windbag full of hot air, and he bluntly states, God has punished your children for their sins. He has no finesse. His opening salvo is designed to bloody Job's nose, to shock him into seeing his own sin and the sin of his children. And Bildad appeals to tradition. Ask the former generations. Find out what their ancestors learned, for you were only born yesterday and know nothing. And our days on earth are but a shadow. So he, in a sense, accuses Job of being a young upstart, born yesterday, knowing nothing. Therefore, he should look to the wisdom of the ages. And just imagine Job in this situation, brokenhearted, mourning the death of his children, and having a friend blame him and his children for that tragedy. It's all your fault, Job. They're getting what they deserve. However, again, at the beginning of the book, there's nothing like that about Job's children. This seems to be a godly man with a godly family, and we know that just in case they sinned, not because they sinned, but just in case, he would sacrifice animals 10 times a year, an animal for each of them. This was a godly family led by a godly man concerned with their spiritual purity. And so Bildad is just totally misguided in what he's saying, and he himself lacks wisdom. Things, the heat gets turned up with each one who speaks. Zophar is the boldest of the friends, and it's almost like he's claiming to speak for God. He's heard Job's speeches, and he... Are all these words to go unanswered? Is this talker to be vindicated? So Job has become the talker who is mocking God and who needs to be rebuked. And so Bildad says, Job, you're claiming to be pure, but God knows better. Your sin is so great, God can't even keep track of it. He's forgotten some of it. Zophar intends to shut Job up and refute his arguments and prove his guilt. So he says, oh, how I wish God would speak, that he would open his lips against you and disclose to you the secrets of wisdom. For Job, wisdom has two sides. And know this, God has even forgotten some of your sin. Zophar is so sure that if God was to speak, he would correct and condemn Job. And when he says wisdom has two sides, he's basically saying, Job, you're only seeing one side of things here. You've got to see God's side. You're such a sinner. If you saw God's side, you would repent because your sin would be obvious. And he goes on, Bildad, to put God's case. Can you fathom the mysteries of God? Can you probe the limits of the Almighty? They are higher than the heavens above. What can you do? They are deeper than the depths below. What can you know? They're being really tough on Job. Charles Swindoll summarizes Zophar's arguments as abrasive legalism. Job, you are guilty, you are ignorant, you are sinful. This is only the first round. There are three more to go, and they get tougher as they go. Becomes more and more intense accusations against him. But then it ends with the three guys giving up on Job. We read, so these three men stopped answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. They just couldn't get through to him. Job would never accept the charges they laid against him. In their view, Job was dangerously wrong in his attitude. Doesn't say he was righteous in God's eyes, but from their point of view, he was righteous in his own eyes. He wasn't going to listen to anyone. They believed they had fairly, honestly proven that Job was not righteous in God's eyes, and they stop because Job isn't listening to them. They think he's beyond rational argument. He's beyond clear thinking. And then Elihu steps onto the scene. We're not going to spend much time on him. Commentators say he is insufferably pompous, arrogant, and insensitive. He enters the fight late when he sees the other three wise men have failed. And we read his anger was aroused. He feels ready to burst and compelled to speak. He comes with a different approach. He says to Job, this suffering is to teach you a lesson. God, through that suffering, Job, through the death of your children, the loss of your livelihood, all this suffering in your health, all of this, the suffering that has come upon you, is God wooing you from the jaws of distress into a spacious place, free from restriction, to the comfort of your table, laden with choice food. So in this view, God is teaching Job a lesson by making him suffer. The idea is that God is shouting at Job through the pain to save him from something worse. But this argument doesn't work. because it's still based on the idea that Job is a sinner, when God has already declared Job to be blameless. So in the end, God rebukes Job's friends. After the Lord had said these things to Job, we read, he said to Eliphaz, the Temanite, "I am angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken the truth about me as my servant Job has." Elihu's outburst isn't mentioned, neither approved nor condemned, but ignored. And although there are elements of truth in what each of these men is saying, there's also misunderstanding, half-truths, legalistically judging Job. Now, when we consider the role of these friends in the Bible, we need to also step back and consider the friendship of God. We've spoken about this before, so I'm not going to go into this in depth. But we all know our friends may fail us, and we may fail our friends. But friendship with God is friendship on a different level. In Proverbs we read, "One who has unreliable friends soon comes to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." Speaking, of course, of God. Of Moses we read, "The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend." And Jesus to his disciples, "Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I have called you friends, for everything I learned from my Father I have made known to you." We understand, I think, this idea of friendship with God, a quality of friendship that's greater than any earthly friendship we may have known. Indeed, as you look at Job, it's his friendship with God, it's his relationship with God, it's his service of God and that connection that he has that helps him through. God never gives to Job an intellectually satisfying answer for his suffering, but we find he is with Job through this. So what difference does this make to us? Well, not all friends are like Job's friends. Even so, we need to take care if friends are influencing us away from God. And we need to think about, what sort of friends are we? This week we had the sad news of the death of our friend Steve Dixon. Steve was something of a lost soul. On the one hand, a gentle giant, but when lost in alcohol, he became violent and served time in prison. He came to faith here. We saw his faith grow. He was baptized in our church in 2012. Some of you will remember him. Some of you won't have met him. A number of our church family extended friendship to Steve, investing time in him, visiting him in prison, writing him letters, seeking to be a positive influence on him. Sadly, a few weeks ago, he took his own life, and we are touched by his loss, and we deeply wish that things had unfolded differently for Stephen. But I want to commend those of you in our parish who were able to befriend Steve and who went the extra mile with him, because it wasn't always easy to be able to do that with him. Through your friendship, we helped Steve develop a friendship with God. Steve may have found it hard to stick to God, but as we learn today, God is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Perhaps in a sense, Steve was that lost sheep who the good shepherd carries home. But it makes us really think about friendship. And the times, maybe for a month, maybe for a week, maybe for a year, we have the ability to be friends and to influence people and to help them come closer to God. Will you and I be the friends people need as they struggle? Will we help to bring peace and hope and spiritual comfort rather than the ill-informed judgment of Job's comforters? I want to encourage you today to deepen your friendship with God and to draw strength from that to be a good friend to others. Amen.